Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Go to the movies, and oftentimes we idolize the performers, putting them on a pedestal, but do not often take into account their human frailties and true dispositions. There are some who will not agree with Christina Crawford, my guest today, about her relationship with her adopted mother, Joan Crawford, while others who knew the family very much do believe what Christine outlined in her book, Mama Dearest. A film based on the book came out in 1981, but many are not aware that the film was made without the participation of Christina, and she never received her approval. Thus, Christina has penned her own documentary biopic, producing it with producer Jerry Rosenberg. Ms. Crawford has also written a novel entitled Black Widow, No Safe Place, and Daughters of the Inquisition. Born in Hollywood, she presently lives in northern Idaho, where she ran a country inn. And Christina was appointed commissioner on the Los Angeles County Commission for Children's Services and has been given awards from the Illinois governor, the California Attorney General, and the United States Department of Children's and Family Services for her work on behalf of public awareness regarding child abuse and family violence prevention. Well, Christine is with us, and it's my great pleasure to welcome her to the show. How are you, Christine?
Oh, thank you. I'm good, Deidre. Today is our opening night at the Snapple Center for Surviving Mommy Dearest. We are here for just a limited run, 5 performances, Wednesday through Sunday. And so we're pretty excited. It's a documentary that has actually won several awards at film festivals and took about 2 years to produce. So it covers about 100 years of show business and then my life. So it's interesting, and I'm on stage about half of the 72 minutes, and then I do questions and answers with the audience, which is totally unscripted and spontaneous.
Well, I must say that I did go to see the show, your documentary film, and as Christina just said, it is at the Snapple Theater on 50th Street and Broadway for those that wish to go. And it'll be there till May 11th.
12th. The Sunday, May 12th, the Mother's Day.
All right. Apropos. And where do you take the film next?
Well, actually, we have a couple of other bookings, but the closest one is the New Hope Film Festival, July 20th. And the city of New Hope is going to be honoring me with an award from their city, Lifetime Achievement Award, for my work in domestic violence and child abuse prevention. So not only does the film get recognized, but they're kind enough to recognize me personally also.
And that's a good thing. And speaking of you personally, let's talk about your earlier life. I know most of the time you were away at school. You started attending Chadwick at age 10, was that correct, in California?
That's right, that's right. And my brother followed a year later, and the two younger siblings started boarding school full-time in first grade.
Now, the school Chadwick, was that mostly a school for Hollywood kids?
Well, it didn't start out that way, but little by little it became a school that a lot of Hollywood parents gravitated toward because it was safe, it was coeducational, it wasn't a military school, it wasn't a religious school, and a lot of people liked that combination.
Well, after that, you barely got to go home before you were transferred to, what was it, Flint Ridge Sacred Heart?
That's right. That's right. I was actually sort of under house arrest, but not because I had done anything wrong, but just because, unfortunately, Joan Crawford was getting worse and worse. She was a very serious alcoholic, and it's too complicated. It's all detailed in, I keep the book alive, so the 30th anniversary edition is available on Amazon, and it's very well detailed in there. But, you know, that was very early in my life, and fortunately, I have lived long enough to do a lot of other different and interesting things.
Thank goodness. Well, why don't you tell me about some of those different and interesting things?
Well, of course, I was an actress for 14 years, and I won the Sarah Siddons Award for my performance in the Chicago company of Barefoot in the Park. After the Bed and Breakfast and Country Inn, I went to work for the Coeur d'Alene Casino, and I booked all their entertainment and did their special events for 7 years, which was a great job, and I loved it. Yeah, it was great. I got to meet all kinds of people, and we had a great time, and it made quite a lot of money for the casino, too. So that was good. And then after that, I had my own regional television show in Spokane on entertainment, and that gave me the opportunity. I wrote it and co-directed it. That gave me the opportunity to do a weekly show, half-hour show, broadcast quality every single week for 13 weeks. So that was another wonderful experience, and we were awarded 3 tellies for excellence in independent broadcasting. Unfortunately, the terrible recession that was visited upon the United States hit at about the same time, and the television station went out of business.
Oh,
so
wow.
I know. Talk about losing your job. About a year later, I went on to be county commissioner to fill a vacancy, and as a result of that experience, I'd been in the county 20 years, so I knew quite a lot about it, but, you know, it's never the same as trying to govern it. So after that, I decided that we had some issues that needed to be addressed. So with a small group of like-minded people, I formed a human rights organization, and we're 3 years old. We just got a civil rights award, and we have a very successful anti-bullying campaign that is coordinated with the national program in October, and we've given out about $1,000 to students who participated, and we've got a very good conversation going with the students themselves.
Well, I understand bullying has become quite almost an epidemic in some schools.
Yes, it has. And when we formed our organization, we went to the superintendents and the principals of the various school districts in the county, and we said, here we are, and we want to be helpful, and what do you see as your most pressing issue? And to a person, they all said bullying. And it's not just physical bullying, which we associate very often with young men, but it's also in middle school particularly, it's the girls on their cell phones.
The girls on their cell phones?
Yes, they are.
Other girls.
They are bullying. Boys? They are intimidating. They are, you know, trashing identified girls. And so it's not just what we used to think of as bullying in the sense of maybe the schoolyard, you know, fist fight or something like that. It's much more psychological, and it's very much a part of social media. So
I was about to say Facebook. I understand they use a lot of Facebook to humiliate.
Yeah. And I think what's happened really is that social media has come upon us all so quickly that nobody has stepped back really seriously and said, you know, what are we doing here, and what as parents can we do to make sure that our children are safer? But anyway, that's not our issue. Our issue is engaging the students in an awareness that bullying is not acceptable behavior, whether it's in the school or anywhere else.
Absolutely. Now, I would say that your mother was a bully. Would you say that?
I would agree totally. You know, anytime you use power in an abusive way, that's bullying. And if you take it to an extreme, that's child abuse and family violence, and it's very destructive, extremely destructive.
Well, those who read the book or saw the movie know of at least two incidents with hangers, and I think there was a episode where you got into a physical altercation.
Yes, and all of that is true. It did happen. It didn't happen the way they did it in the movie, but it is all documented in the book itself. So that's why I keep the book in print. I own the rights. I got the rights back to all my books, and thank you for mentioning some of them. So I keep that book in print so that it's now a generation in the present that was hardly born sometimes when the book was first published. So it's important that some people who wish to do so have access to the actual real, factual, authentic story.
Is that why you decided to produce and write Surviving Mommy Dearest, so you could tell your actual story? As I mentioned before, you weren't privy to the movie. They didn't consult you.
Right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Yes and no. I wanted to make sure that in this day of social media, that my voice was heard from me. And in social media now, people can make things up, and there's no fact checking, and it goes out, and other people believe it to be the truth, and it may and it may not be. So I felt that it was important, and I have a wonderful producer, Jerry Rosenberg, who thought this it was important also to have my story in my own words in perpetuity. And the film can be a standalone. It does play that way in film festivals, but this is a combination of the film and my presence on stage. So it's sort of a multimedia one-woman show, but it's kind of a hybrid. So it's interesting. It's interesting for me to do, and I think it's interesting for the audience.
Well, what I found interesting is that both your brother and yourself received the abuse, but the two twin girls, she was different with them?
Well, they were 8 years younger. I don't really know, because we grew up completely separately. One of the two girls has passed away. I don't really know what the truth of their situation was, because I never saw it. And, you know, I don't like to suppose that I know something that I didn't actually see for myself. So I'll just let it go and say they had a different experience. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I really don't know.
Well, were there ever any happy moments between you and your mom? Did you
know
love
ever? Everybody asks that because they want that to be true, but that was very few and far between, and it got to be less and less as we got older. And it was we didn't see her sometimes for years at a time, years, not days or months or weeks, years. So basically, she put everybody in boarding schools and went on with her life, whatever that was.
And never visited.
She never visited, no.
Called?
I beg your pardon?
Or called or wrote or?
Well, once in a while, yeah, we were supposed to call her, but they were usually very difficult conversations, and we tried to make sure that they happened before 5 o'clock in the afternoon because she was an alcoholic, and that was a disaster.
Amazing. Well, you know, what is really amazing to me is that people had to have seen that, and nothing was done? No one tried to come to your rescue?
Well, many people saw, but there were no laws to protect children in those days. And the people that saw and maybe tried to say something were basically told that it was none of their business. And because everybody was associated with the film industry, they were intimidated, and I won't say they were threatened, but the implication was that if they continued to make trouble, they could lose their job. And, of course, that would have been, you know, completely horrible for them.
I mean, that came from Joan, or that came from the Hollywood bigwigs?
I think intimidation, you can never put your finger on very accurately, but the implication was there.
Hmm. I wondered about that, because at one point you were saying that she was so difficult that the staff, she couldn't keep staff, and that fans took over. Was she the same way with her fans?
Sometimes yes, but by that time she was with some of them, a few of them that were very docile people, very timid people. But by that time she knew that they were the only hope that she had, because the employment agencies would not send anybody, because the people that they had sent and quit or got fired, they went back and told the agencies what the situation was, and the word got out, so nobody, you know, except for like a special event or something where it was one day. But other than that, she couldn't get anybody from the employment agencies.
Right. That's why I was thinking her career meant more to her than anything, that she would probably not want her fans to see the real Joan.
Well, they saw, but, you know, they were, it was a different time. It was, you know, people were not used to speaking up and speaking out. So they were, I'm sure, thrilled to tell their friends that, you know, they were doing heavy labor at the outdoor furniture washing or whatever they were doing. I think they were thrilled to be in the presence of, you know, glamour and stardom.
Well, what about the men in Joan's life? Did she marry about 3 times or 4 times?
Well, that's up for discussion. I don't know. There is some speculation that she was married before she came to Hollywood, when she was dancing at nightclubs in Chicago and Detroit, but I don't know that for sure. And so for what we really know is she was married 4 times to Douglas Fairbanks, French Otone, Philip Terry, and Alfred Steele.
And were any of those gentlemen father figures to you?
No. All but Philip Terry and Alfred Steele were in relationships with her before I was born. And Alfred Steele, Terry, those relationships only lasted 3 years. One ended with Mr. Terry in divorce, and the other, Al Steele, in his death.
Right. And he was the Pepsi-Cola.
Yes, he was. Yes, and beloved genius of a man.
You got along well with him?
Well, the little bit that I was permitted to see him, yes. I mean, you understand, I was a teenager and I was on my own at that time. I didn't live at school, and I very rarely saw them. And it was only 3 years start to finish.
Oh, I see. Well, here's my question. Usually someone that abuses was abused themselves. Do you think that was the case with Joan?
I think she came out of abject poverty, which is abusive, but I don't know that she was physically abused. I think all through her life she had to deal with, you know, the power structure and manipulation and all that kind of thing. She was a very tough person, and life had made her that way.
Oh, you could see it in her face. I must admit that there are a couple of movies that she made that I like Mildred Pierce. But I never felt drawn to her because she always looked so mean.
Well, in her later films, I don't mean the final ones, but the ones that she did at her brothers, like Harriet Craig and Damn Don't Cry, and some of those B-movies that they called them then, you can see that in Queen Bee, she wasn't acting. I saw it once, and it almost made me ill because she was exactly the way she was at home.
She looked
and
hard.
It was really scary. It was very scary.
Oftentimes,
so she wasn't acting. That was just the way she was. You know.
Well, I really think that somebody should have suggested to her, because it wasn't just alcoholism. There seemed to be a mental illness. Or am I overstepping myself here?
No, I don't think you are, because a lot of people tried to talk to her get her to get counseling or therapy. Of course, it wasn't like today, and, you know, it's not that great, but it's certainly better. But she refused to even acknowledge that there might be a problem, ever.
Ever.
So, yeah, so there's nothing you can do when somebody refuses to, you know, they choose to stay in denial, and they think nobody notices, and, you know, they refuse to get help, and their lives suffer, and so does everybody else's around them.
Well, how did it affect you? I mean, come on, when someone has gone through that, there has to be, you have to also need therapy, because it's such a devastating thing to be unloved and then mistreated and no one coming to your rescue.
Right. Well, in the years since Mommy Dearest has been published, there's been some really positive work done for survivors, because nobody knew, well, it was never a national conversation, and so the therapeutic community didn't have really much of a clue as to how to help people. But in the 80s, I worked pretty tirelessly to get that conversation started in social services and in therapy. So the laws have changed, the protocols have changed, the training has changed. But the most serious part for survivors is that you spend so much time being hypervigilant about what disaster is about to befall you that you don't have the time to pay attention to the skills that you should be learning as a child. And when that happens, you have to learn those skills as an adult. Hard to do, because it should have been just a natural part of child development year after year, and by the time you get to be an adult, you have a range of skills that will serve you in adulthood. But survivors don't have those skills, and so they enter adulthood with some very, very hard things that they have to learn, and I hear about them all the time. I mean, all the time.
Well, one thing is it difficult, because not knowing love, is it difficult to express love, for example, in a marriage or whatever, or a relationship with a man?
Well, first, in order to express love, you have to have some trust, and survivors don't have any trust, and for good reason. So trust is the first thing that needs to be worked on, and when you're trying to figure out who to trust and who's trustworthy when you're an adult, it's not so easy, because you don't know. You don't have the normal give and take that children have, so that they learn by doing. If you learn by doing, yourself, you're going to find yourself in some really difficult positions and situations. So the first thing is about trust, and the second thing is about self-esteem. Without those things, and survivors have self-esteem, they may have some narcissism or sense of self-entitlement and victimization, but they don't have much self-esteem. And without trust and self-esteem, how do you have a relationship? Well, you don't. That's the truth of it.
But eventually, as yourself, you found a way. Did you find a way? Being in Idaho, has that been very beneficial to you?
That's been the best thing I ever did. I've been there 20 years, and I went there not knowing a soul. And I found a piece of property and built my country in and ran it for all those years. And I have worked all my life, so the public fantasy is that I made a lot of money and I have a lot of money. No, that's not true. I've always worked all my life, and I need to work. So I'm happy to do that. I'm healthy. The past doesn't run my present, and I am extremely grateful for that. But it took a lot of soul searching and hard work and being myself.
I can imagine, because I've met people that have had terrible childhoods, and it's like you're haunted by it all your life. Do you feel that aspect of it, that it's always kind of there?
No.
Or you've gotten
yeah,
past that?
Right. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't run my present, and that's, you know, you have to pay a price for that, and you have to do the hard work. But it isn't necessary for your past to run your present or be a factor in life. But, you know, having said that, you know, you just have to do the hard work. And a lot of people just don't want to do that. You know, they rather stay being the victim. Because but it's not a happy place, I'll tell you that much.
Well, did you think that Joan was unhappy, that's why she adopted kids? Because why did she do it if she didn't want to be with them?
I think she was seeking unconditional love, like with puppies, kittens, and babies. But that's not a bad thing, except that if you expect that to be given all the time as the child grows, rather than to be giving to the child, then the roles are completely reversed, and you're going to be disappointed. And I think she was disappointed. I know she was disappointed because we didn't remain babies. And so she would adopt more children. But I think the other part of it was that during those times, she was never married when she adopted, and so she couldn't adopt through normal social services at that time because it wasn't permitted. But she also did it for publicity, because she got endless magazine spreads in the movie magazines, and she built a reputation of being this, you know, woman that took in orders. And it was a very positive image for her when she wasn't working and couldn't get publicity any other way.
That, you know, when I think about that, I just think that it's just a terrible thing that she couldn't see her children and love them, because that's part of, that should have been part of her life, and I think it would have made of her a better person.
I think it would have made her a happier person, to address the question that you asked before. Was she happy or unhappy? I think she was absolutely miserable in life. But I think that's partly why she drank and took pills and, you know, toward the end of her life. It was just a dangerous situation. But, you know, at some point, one has to say, okay, look at you, look at your life, and those are choices. Those are choices that you are making. And until you make some other kind of choices based in better reality, you're going to have what you get, because those choices are going to get you the same thing over and over and over and over again. And some people just don't want to look at that or deal with that. It's tough. I mean, it's really hard. What we're talking about is really, really, really hard stuff. And it's very hard to do it all by yourself. It's much healthier if you can find some kind of support. But it has to be done until we can get to the point as a society where we just say, hey, wait a second, abuse and violence in the family is just non-acceptable behavior. And help people get parenting classes and counseling and all that kind of stuff. And until as a society we agree to do that together, we're going to have the same situation over and over and over again. So it's a pathetic situation, though.
Indeed it is. And I have, we're getting close to the end of our time, so I have another question. Is, you know, Hollywood is very youth-orientated and beauty-orientated, and Joan Crawford was aging. Do you feel that in some ways, because she kept sabotaging your career, that she was jealous of your youth and beauty?
Sure, and Deidre, it took me a long time to get my mind around the fact that, you know, such a big movie star could be jealous of me, pathologically jealous. I mean, she even tried to take my job. And once I realized that, I was just astonished. I mean, I really couldn't talk to anybody about it because nobody would believe me. But I had to come to that realization myself. And finally, the third or fourth time that it happened, and I was totally sabotaged with no ability to rectify the situation, I just said, hey, guys, I'm out of here. I got to find another way to live because this is ridiculous. So that's when I went back to college and got a master's degree and went to work with corporate America.
Oh, well, I want to also mention that, again, that your film, Surviving Mama Dearest, is at the Snapple Theater, which is located at 1627 Broadway.
And 50th Street. There's an entrance with an elevator on 50th Street.
And that's 210 West 50th Street.
Yeah. And we'll be there tonight, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Mother's Day. Sunday we have a 12 noon matinee, and we definitely have tickets available, so we really hope to see a lot of people there. And I look forward to meeting them, and thank you so much, Deidre, for this time.
You're certainly welcome, and let me give them the box office number if they want to purchase tickets. That's 212-921-7862, and that's tickets to Surviving Mama Dearest.
Thank you, Deidre.
Thank you so much, Christina Crawford, for coming on my show today. It's been
my
pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
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 And, well, we are nearing the end of our show, so I'm going to sign off and thank my audience for making my topically yours. And I'm Deirdre Schuler, as always. We've been talking to Christina Crawford, and this is the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. Been listening to the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.